So I can tell spring is in the air when I start seeing my grapevines start putting leaves on, pecan trees start putting leaves on, and the first thing, fruit-wise, to come along in the spring are these puppies right here. And not a lot of people know about these, because not everybody's got a mulberry tree in the backyard.
Do you remember that day you come in and asked me what kind of tree that was growing blackberries?
Blackberry tree.
I tell you what, I was grown before I ever seen one.
They are good. You know, they'll stain your hands. They're a little bit different. They're not seedy like a blackberry, and they got that stem in there you kind of work around. Well, they are good. We made some wine off these a year or so ago. It was real good.
They make good jelly, too. You don't know. Show one up there for everybody.
It looks like kind of a long blackberry.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's say hey to everybody, and then we can go on. I'm going to show them what these look like.
All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Row by Row Garden Show. We're excited to have you with us tonight. I'm Travis.
And I'm Greg.
And we've got a really good show planned for you, and just want to show you these mulberries.
Mulberries.
Because some of them are a little longer than others there. And you don't know how many people I've had stop by or that had come by the house and asked me what kind of tree that was. I only know of one other feller down the road in town.
Old man Harry.
Yeah. So not a lot of people got them, but they're nice trees and they make real good.
And the birds absolutely love them. When they start getting real ripe and start falling off, you talking about some bird feed, man, the birds eat them up.
You got to get it. You got to be diligent about picking them, because when they get ready, they'll start falling off the tree and the birds will knock them off. You get a real heavy rainstorm, they'll knock them off. But these things are good to me. I really like them. You want some more?
I think I will.
So mulberries are coming in.
Sweet.
My old taters, my old slow growing taters, finally, the red ones at least, got up enough to where they needed to be, had a little dirt throw to them. So I healed my red taters yesterday afternoon.
So did I.
And that kind of made me feel better about things. It's just having to be patient. They ain't as big as everybody else's taters, but they're gonna, got a feeling they're gonna get there.
Taters just seem to do better in sandy soils.
Yeah.
And you got kind of that clay lumpy soil there for the time being. And just taters love that sandy soil, and they just gonna do a little bit better in those type of soils.
I think what happened was that piece of seed tater there, because that soil's kind of clumpy and rocky and stuff, that it took it a lot longer to get a good foothold down there with the roots.
What happened was is you didn't have enough soil to seed contact there.
Right, right.
You had some air pockets in there that caused some problems.
Yeah, and couldn't get a good toehold.
Yeah, so that, while we're on that subject here, I don't care what kind of seed you're planting, when you can increase that soil to seed contact, your germination is a lot better. Prime example of that, if you've ever planted anything and went behind it and packed it or rolled it, that will help your germination a lot. So, takes those air pockets out of there.
We're going to get there. It's going to take some time. We're going to get that soil built up. Your corn's coming up. You had your corn video, your honey select. I saw it earlier. It looks good out there.
Yep.
Probably have to thin it out just a hair.
Yep, that's okay. I'd much rather thin than I had to put skips in.
Yeah, I would too. I got the drip tape laid for my corn, my incredible corn, and I'm waiting on it to dry out. I messed up. So it always happens if I decide to lay my drip and plant on separate days, it'll come a big rain and then throw my schedule all off. So as soon as it dries back out, I'm gonna plant my incredible sweet corn.
Well, you know, we've had a dry spring around here. We did get a rain last night that we needed. We've had kind of a dry spring, so it indicates to me we may end up having a dry spring when we had a wet one last year. So that drip tape's really gonna pay off this year. I can already tell. I wish I'd used it more than I did earlier in the year, because I'm having to do quite a bit of overhead irrigation that I wouldn't have to do. Now, I did put it underneath my tomatoes and my pole beans and my corn and all that, and I'm gonna continue to do that, but I didn't put it underneath my onions, and I could have seen where it came in handy.
It has on mine. I've been every other, until we went almost a month there, it seemed, without a good rain, and I was running on my onions every other day for 3 or 4 hours at a time. and you could go out there the next day after run it 4 hours and they'd soaked it up or it had evaporated up.
And the shallots are looking good. We're really excited about these shallots. I thought we were going to have something.
Pulled yours in?
I have not pulled them, but I'm keeping the juice poured to them and they green and they're growing and man, they're looking good.
I got some elephant garlic stalks. It's about big as around my wrist. Yeah. Yeah. And my leeks is coming along too. Now I'm going to have to do some either some research or kind of ask the audience. I ain't sure when I'm supposed to harvest them leeks. I don't know if you wait till the tops die off or wait till they get a certain size.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure on that.
But they still growing, kicking, right. Looking good. So I'm going to just leave them down there for the time being. I want to show everybody these right here. Things wet, heavy. So this is a whole tray of red burgundy okra. I'm getting this wet there, ain't I? And these ain't long from being ready to go in the ground. I'd say probably another week or so, and these would be ready to go. If you want to be the first one to have okra, this right here is the way to do it. And I had somebody on a Facebook group the other day asking about growing okra from transplants, if they had any success with it. And it always works really great for us.
Yeah, you just got to be a little bit careful. And I've made a mistake before, even with transplants, putting them in the dirt too early. I don't like to put my okra in before the 1st of April, even if it's a transplant.
Oh, right. Yeah. So, next week or the next 2 weeks, these babies will be ready to go down. And we'll just set those on a 1 foot spacing on top of every drip emitter and be good to go.
What's your row spacing on your okra?
I've done it a couple different ways, and I seem like I just change. I go back. So I've done a double row before, and that works really good because you conserve some space and you can pick it from both sides. But lately, I've been going with a 3 to 4 foot so I can get in there. It depends on if you prune it or not. If you keep it pruned, you don't need it as wide but when it gets big and if you don't prune it, it can be tough to find.
Yeah, if I was growing for a market garden or for production, I'd go on a 3 foot row, but I plant mine on 4 foot. Gives me plenty of room to get in there and work.
Depends on how much room you got.
Yep. If you got it, I'd say 4 foot. You'll appreciate that when you start getting in there and having to cut it every other day.
That's right. And then we both got our tomatoes planted, but our peppers, we just started stepping these up. So this is what we step them up to.
Call it an 1801.
3-inch pot, something like that.
4-inch is what they call it.
4-inch pot. Yeah. So we buy these. They come in. These are all connected. I think they're 18 to a flat. And
they go in a regular, what we call a 10-20 tray.
The little holding tray. And so I've been going out the greenhouse and we've got about 10 varieties of peppers out there, and I've been trying to step up a couple every day. And this is a Cuban ale there. Now, I like to step them up out of those trays like you've seen there when they start getting that second set of true leaves. I don't want them to get root bound in that tray. So once they get that second set of true leaves, or you can actually see a third set coming along there, that's when I'll step them
up. Now, the farmers plant them directly out of that.
They will.
Directly out of that tray there. And we plant our tomatoes out of there. The only thing we really step up is peppers. And maybe an eggplant or two.
So once you put them in this right here, and it takes them a couple days to get acclimated, but once they get in here and they start growing roots and you shoot fertilizer to them, they will take off.
Yep.
And those right there. And then the last thing before we get into tonight's main subject, you want to do a drum roll?
Not really.
Okay. Let's show everybody this beautiful piece of equipment right here.
Yeah, we just come out with this. We got it in production. We've been working on it a while. We showed y'all the prototype here a while back. But we have got these, and we'll have them in stock probably in the morning.
Well, as of the airing of this video, they should be on the website. So if you go to the website, under Garden Tools, there's the tab that says Long Handle Tools. And you can see it right there. So
I'm more in charge of assembly than I am.
Assembly. So we got we did a lot of research on this before we developed it, folks. And I can promise you, there's several companies out there making a handheld stirrup hoe, but this is the best one best made one you'll find. This design right here with this square peg handle and this shaft that comes around it here is the sturdiest one we found and the most reliable.
Yeah, all these metal parts are made right here in Georgia. We get that handle there out of Arkansas, and it's an ash handle. And this is 3/8 metal, and this is 1095 spring steel right here. We've used this design for quite a while now on our wheel hose, and we just took it and made it so we could put it on a handle. We got a 60-inch ash handle there, nice thick handle. So this ain't no baby toy. This is a get her done type toy.
And that 6-inch handle for your real tall folks. I'm 6'1", and I choke up on this 60-inch handle a little bit. So it's gonna work for everybody of all heights. We went with a 1/4-inch, 3/8-inch steel here. So it's a little lighter, a little more maneuverable and workable than the one on our wheel hoe. Same blade as on our wheel hoe there, sharp on both sides. I mean, we are pumped about this baby.
If you was to ever wear that out, and I've yet seen one wear out, you can replace those blades. We have replacement blades for them.
That's right. So go on the website, check that out right there. We'll probably have some videos coming out with that pretty soon. But a beautiful tool and a hard-working tool.
Yeah, we're real proud of that baby right there.
That's a handle's pretty long. Maybe I can get it back over here. All right. So, tonight's show, we're going to be talking about winter squash. And if you have any questions, as always during the show, put those in the comments, please. And we'll be glad to get to them on next week's show. But you don't know, I've had, seems like more than ever recently, a lot of people calling and asking about winter squash. Why are you talking about winter squash when it's spring? So winter squash doesn't mean we plant them in the winter.
Nope, just opposite.
We plant them in spring, usually a few weeks after our summer squash. They like a little warmer soil to germinate, so we wait here till about April. And then they're usually, most of them are around 90 to 100 days, so we'll end up harvesting early July. And then most of them store really well, sometimes up 6 to 8 months
into the winter. Hence the name winter squash. Now our friends up north, we do some business, and I travel up there quite a bit to Amish country in Ohio. They have one growing season. Well, we have two growing seasons, mm-hmm. and we grow ours in the springtime because we don't grow them in the fall because we have so much insect and disease pressure. So we grow ours in spring. However, up there they have one growing season. So they grow them during the summertime, and then they have them come off during what we call the fall.
Right, yeah. So we could technically plant ours around July 4th and try to get them to come off in October, but the disease.
I have done that. We technically could grow two crops, and we could grow a spring and a fall crop. But you're taking a gamble on that fall crop down south as far as we are on kind of the insects. And if we have a bad white fly year, it is tough. Now, if you have a easy white fly year like we did last year and you keep your mildews under control, you'll be successful doing it.
So if you want pumpkins in the fall, you can plant them in the spring. They'll be ready in July and they'll still be good. In fact, a lot of times those pumpkins get better as they cure a little bit. Keep them in storage, yep. Just like your onions, your potatoes.
Now, my thoughts on winter squash is I think it's one of the most under-recognized food sources for the home gardener. I think more people should be growing them. I think more people should be aware of them because it is something you can grow. And when it gets ready, it stores for a long period of time without any refrigeration or any special care. That's right. All you got to do after it matures is put it in your barn, just like you would your onions, and where you got a little bit of airflow in a shady area that's halfway cool, and then babies will last. And it is a great food source that you don't have to worry about refrigeration, you don't have to worry about canning, you don't have to worry about freezing or anything like that. And I have really come to appreciate the taste of them a lot more in the last 3 or 4 years.
Any crop that's a one-time harvest that stores really well, to me, is an extremely valuable crop for the vegetable garden. Onions, potatoes, sweet potatoes, garlic, and winter squash. Anything that I can just go out there and grab one off the shelf underneath the barn, you know, cut it in half, throw it in the oven, makes it really nice. And they're pretty maintenance free to grow. I don't really recommend growing these kind of in the middle of your garden because they're going to sprawl a little bit. But it's nice to have your little dedicated winter squash plot. And you can plant them in their rows as close as 3 to 4 feet. But what's going to happen is they're just going to sprawl over the whole area, kind of like watermelons.
Yeah.
And you might have to wheel hoe it initially a little bit, but they're going to cover the ground. You're not going to have to really deal with a lot of weed issues. If you got them on drip, the water's not going to really be a problem. And then you just let them go until the vines die off, and it's a one-time harvest. You go in there, some pruners.
Just about all of them, right here is a Seminole pumpkin. When it gets to the point where you can't dig into it with your fingernail, that rind gets pretty tough here. That means they're mature and ready to harvest.
And that'll stem get hard on them.
The stem get hard on them. Yeah, now this is not something you grow on a patio. You got to have room to grow these. And I wouldn't recommend anybody planting them unless you had a 20 by 20 or 20 by 30 area minimum to plant them.
I would say 20 by 20. But, you know, if you've got a little extra spot on your yard or backyard or wherever that you can till you up a little 20 by 20 spot, be a perfect little side garden.
Now, most of these are 90 days to maturity, which is a good bit
longer.
Or longer, which is a good bit more than a regular squash. Regular squash can come off 55 days. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about twice the length of time that you would for a regular summer squash. So drip irrigation is very important to put underneath these right here. It also helps with that powdery and downy mildew that you know you're going to have a problem with. So always put drip irrigation in all my winter squash.
That's right. That's right. Now, let's talk about squash in general. There are three species of squash, because people always want to know, can I plant this with this without it cross-pollinating? And there's three species. They all have the genus Cucurbita, because they're all cucurbits.
So there's, I'll go with that.
There's Cucurbita maxima, there's Cucurbita pepo, and there's Cucurbita moschata, or moscata. I'm not quite sure how
moscata. I like that better.
Okay. So let's go through these. So the Cucurbita maxima are things like your kabocha, your Hubbard squash, your Georgia candy roaster, the red curry, which we've grown before. So a lot of your real sweet things that people use a lot of time for pumpkin pies.
And if you go to the grocery store and buy a canned pumpkin, more likely you're getting one of those varieties you just mentioned.
The Cucurbita maxima.
Right.
That's right.
That's what the commercial guys grow for the canning plants.
Mm-hmm. Now the second one here, the Cucurbita pepo, includes our summer squash, but it also includes some of the popular winter squash varieties. It includes delicata, mm-hmm. Okay, spaghetti squash, acorn squash, and your jack-o'-lanterns are in the pepo species there. And then the last one, the moscata, is your butternut, your Seminole, your fairy tale pumpkin, the ones that tend to have kind of a browner skin. And the moscata are said to be more heat tolerant, which makes sense. And they're also a little more resistant to insect pressure.
I did not know that.
So your butternuts, your Seminoles, those types with the kind of tanner skin.
Where's the blue kabocha? Where does it fall under? Not blue kabocha, excuse me.
The bayou. Blue bayou, I think, would go under the maxima
okay. There.
So we've got 7 varieties of winter squash. And we kind of want to go through them and talk about each one of them. We've grown most all these before, if not going to grow them this year. So the first one, I'll let you talk about this one. This is one of your favorites.
Yeah, this is my favorite here. Delicata. This one, I got reintroduced to winter squash back later in my life. This is the one I fell in love with right here. It doesn't store as well as the rest of them. I think about they recommend 30 to 45 days. Now, I've gotten longer than that out of them. But 30 to 45 days storage on these right here, which is out of the winter squash, is the lesser. Most of them store a lot longer than that. So this one doesn't have the storing capability, but taste-wise is off the chain for me.
Were you saying winter squash helped you through a midlife crisis?
I would sort of maybe say that. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, the 100 days to maturity, and it says here after last frost. Now, in our zone, this is what Greg does. I don't plant these till the 1st of April, to at least the 1st of April.
Right. Which is a few weeks after the last frost.
They're 90 to 100 day maturity, so let's figure it up. We got April, May, and June. Now I have some coming off around the 4th of July, which is perfect.
That's right.
Which is perfect for us. So there you got Delicata. If you hadn't tried it.
So how big do those get? Can you tell, give people an idea
fruit, how big? Some of them get about yay long.
Eight?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's perfect for two people. You split them in half. We roast them in the oven. We have cubed them up and put olive oil on them, all that kind of stuff. We normally just split them in half, core out the seeds, put them in the oven, roast them with some seasoning stuff on them. Perfect. One of them is perfect for two people.
Yeah, most of your winter squash, the good thing about them, they're so easy to cook because really all you do is cut them in half, sit them in the oven, maybe put a little olive oil on them, and then once they're done, you just scoop them out with a spoon. Really nice. Okay, the next one here is a new one. We've had kabocha squash before and grown kabocha before, but this variety here called Hai, H-A-I kabocha, is exclusive to us. And it's supposed to be one of the sweetest and best tasting squash that you've ever put
in. Is it a hybrid?
It is a hybrid. It's resistant to zucchini yellow mosaic virus, which is evidently something that these kabocha squash can get. And I'm growing some of these this year. I'm probably waiting. After I get my corn planted, I'll probably start focusing on the winter squash and plant these in the next few weeks. So I'm gonna grow some of these. These store pretty well. They have a harder rind on them. Nice yellow flesh in there. And I would say with the Delicata, these right here are right up there as far as the sweetness of the taste. They're just absolutely amazing. You can use them in soups or just eat them cut up. The next one here is this Hoss butternut squash.
Which is also exclusive to us.
Yes. And what makes this more unique than your regular Waltham or regular butternut squash is these right here don't have that big pronounced bulb on the bottom. So a lot of your butternuts have that kind of skinny neck and then the pronounced bulb looks like a light bulb. These right here are more uniform all the way through and they're supposed to be extra super productive. So that's an exclusive variety that we've got that we're really excited about.
Can I do this one?
That one, do that one next.
You do that one, that's your baby right there.
Okay, and then the last one, we kind of separated these out. We'll do the pumpkins here in a minute. The last one here, which is my favorite, and one of the most productive crops you can grow in the garden, is this Small Wonder Spaghetti Squash. And I've got videos out on this guy here. You can get, I'd say on average, about 15 fruits per plant. I grew a 60-foot row of them last year with about 3-foot spacing, and man, I had over 250 of these things I harvested. Buckets and buckets and buckets of them. They're smaller than your grocery store spaghetti squash. They're kind of personal size for two folks or one folk if you're real hungry.
If you're a big boy.
Yeah. So, but if you want something that's going to blow your mind as far as how many fruit it's going to produce, this Small Wonder Spaghetti Squash is great. And I'm actually growing in my plot there, my winter squash plot. I'm going to plant half in this and half in this. And since this is Pepo and this is Maxima, I don't have to worry about them.
Cross-pollinate.
That's right.
Wow.
Okay, let's get to, we got three pumpkin varieties that we're really excited about. I'll let you start.
Okay, Seminole pumpkin that we've grown for quite a while now. And this one right here is the one I grew last year. These are absolutely the most disease and insect resistant pumpkin variety I've ever seen. The story is these things were found down in the Everglades of Florida. The Seminole Indians used to grow them for a food source, and they're native to the southeastern United States. Now, if you live in southern Louisiana, southern Georgia, southern Alabama, or Florida, any southern states where we have a problem growing regular pumpkins, you can grow these, and they're good to eat. But the main thing is they're resilient. Man, they are super resilient. So there you have the Seminole pumpkin.
What old John Anderson say? Said, way down south in the Everglades.
Way down south. All right, fairy tale pumpkin. And you probably heard me tell a story on this one right here before. I found this one in Germany, in Mannheim, Germany, at a farmer's market one day. And me and no boy couldn't communicate very well. He spoke German, I spoke South Georgian. And we finally got to the point where he could give me some seeds. So he reached down there and got me a handful of seeds, and I smuggled them back in the United States.
Be careful, border control.
Well, man. I thought I had some. I thought I had it onto a new variety. So what I did was I come back and started doing my research. Well, come to find out, there was plenty of these seeds in the United States and people were growing. I did not know that. So we started growing the fairy tale, which is Muscadet.
Over there, they call it Muscadet de Provence.
That's better than what I would do with it. It is an absolutely beautiful pumpkin, and we can grow these pretty. It's an heirloom variety. It's a French heirloom variety, mm-hmm. And we can grow these fine in springtime. Now, I can't grow them in the fall, but we can grow them fine in springtime. It has a bright orange flesh to it, mm-hmm. And man, these things get absolutely beautiful for a pie pump.
And there ain't a lot of wasted space inside that pumpkin there. I mean, it is meaty. The wall of meat in there is, I'd say, at least 4 to 5 inches thick.
And they're pretty good size, so when they get ready, go ahead and plan on this meat inside there, put it in the freezer, because there's no way you can take a quarter one inch right there and feed a pretty good sized family. So what we've done is we quartered them up, cooked them down, and we froze that puree in there for later times.
What you're saying is you're probably gonna eat a whole pumpkin.
That's where
time.
I'm trying what I'm getting to.
I got you.
All right, big Bayou pumpkin.
Blue Bayou.
Big blue, excuse me, it is. Drill press bit me yesterday on my arm and I got a little Band-Aid on it.
Uh-oh.
This right here is one I'm gonna grow this year. Never grown it before, but it's got really good reviews about it. This one right here is a hybrid, and it's supposed to be extra sweet, and it is powdery mildew resistant and downy mildew resistant. So I'm gonna plant me a pretty good area of these right here. I'm excited about these bad boys. They pretty, and we're gonna see how they turn out.
So what's unique about these is you've got the blue pumpkin, the heirloom blue pumpkin that kind of looks like that is called Jaredale.
Right.
And as with a lot of these heirloom pumpkins, they just aren't that productive, and especially down here, boy, they're just susceptible and will get eaten up in a heartbeat. This is a blue pumpkin that tastes really good, and it's got that resistance. So if you've ever wanted to grow a blue pumpkin and have that kind of hybrid productivity and disease resistant, yep, that's your way to go with the Blue Bayou there. So check out all of those, the butternut, spaghetti, kabocha, delicata. Pick you out one of those to grow, get you a little 20 by 20 or bigger, and get those. I forgot about that.
Look there, folks. We had a customer come in earlier in the week from Dade City, Florida. Miss Joanne brought me two of these right here. Now, I have done ate one of them. But I want y'all to look at the size onion she had grown. She was proud of them, and she ought to be. Look at there. That is a fine species of an onion right there. Now, Dade City's right above Tampa, so they're a good bit ahead of us in zone 9.
That onion, just to give you an idea, folks, in diameter, that's a good size onion there. It's at least 6-7 inches in diameter.
Yeah.
Way bigger than a softball.
Oh, yeah. I've never grown them that big.
She growed them from Sets, a special variety, and we're going to try to get our hands on some of them.
Yeah, I'd like to try some of them.
We will see. We will see. I imagine you got to pour the water to them right there to get them.
Yeah, she talked about the way she grew them. It's just like the way we do. You pull, you know, as they start getting bigger, you take your sweeps or whatever and pull the soil back from them and give them room. So that's
plenty of fertilizer.
Plenty of water. She knows what she's doing.
That's right. How big are your? Mine are about baseball size.
And growing by the day. Now, they start to really kick it off.
Yeah, I'm baseball size or a little bit smaller on all mine. All right, let's get to some of our questions this week. And as always, if we answer your question on the show, send us an email to cusserve@hosstools.com and we'll send you a nice prize. What do we got here?
What's his name? I can't read it.
I think that says Cleoli. I don't know how.
Cleoli says, is it too late to me to start green beans in Tampa, Florida? Pole or bush? Pole means they climb, right?
That's right. So pole beans means they're going to climb, and you need a panel or something other for them to grow on. I personally like pole beans because they're easier to pick and harvest. I don't think it's too late if you live in Tampa to start some. Now, when it gets real hot, they will drop blooms and not make. But
Well, she, as long as she get them off by the end of May, she's going to be okay.
Yeah, she's going to get several 50 good
days
harvests.
To maturity on either one of them.
We got two nice varieties. We got the rattlesnake, which I'm growing, and then we got your Kentucky Wonder, good old classic standby pole bean there. Can't go wrong with either of those.
Get them in the ground, though. I mean, you need to be getting them in the ground if you're in Tampa, Florida.
That's right.
You figure you'd come to your latest days of maturity would be the end of May. Back it up there for 50 days, and that would be the last time I'd plant.
That's right. Okay, and then our second question here comes from Constance Lovejoy. And we were talking about pollinators last week. And she said, can trees serve as pollinators? Which ones and which is better for pollinators, flowers or trees?
Oh, absolutely, trees can serve as pollinators. Bees love trees when they bloom them. Mm-hmm. The thing about trees is you kind of have to think ahead of time, several years ahead, to grow trees for bees. And that's the reason we like flowers, because you can pop them in the ground and get them to bloom stage quick. Bees love both. Flowers are easier and quicker. If you need something, boom, put them in the ground, grow them, you got some good pollinators. If you plant in a homestead for later on and you want to plant some stuff, absolutely, trees are wonderful. And I've come up with some varieties here that are really good for bees. Of course, any of your native oaks, or think about your native trees that bloom in the springtime, and then you're gonna have something that's probably gonna be successful. Try to stay away from things that are not native in your area, or that's not proven to be grown in your area. Just like us this far in the south, we can't grow an apple tree. So, mm-hmm. I mean, apple trees are wonderful for bees. We just can't have trouble growing apple trees, so you wouldn't want to do that. So a magnolia that we grow here in the south are absolutely wonderful bees. Uh-huh. Bees love them, and they bloom for a period of time. The tupelo tree, which is kind of a southern thing, and probably tupelo honey is the most prized honey of all.
Right.
Bees love tupelo. Tupelo grows in the swamp. It grows on the rivers and the wetlands. Tulip poplar trees, black cherry tree, any kind of fruit tree, bees love.
The only thing I would add there is with trees, you got to realize that bloom session is going to be relatively short-lived compared to that of the flower. So,
right.
Yes, it will attract pollinators, but you're not going to get the longevity out of it that you would flowers. If you plant some zinnias in spring, those rascals are going to bloom.
And if you do succession plantings, especially if you keep some coming along,
yeah,
you would have pollinators or food for your pollinators all summer long.
So you're going to benefit from both. Flowers are probably going to be a little bit easier, and you'll get some more longevity out of them as well.
Yep.
All right. That's going to do it for us tonight, and we got to get out here, dry out a little bit, and get to putting together some more of these stirrup hose. Check those out, and we will see you guys on next week's show.
Have a good one.